I just wish that you would use America the Beautiful. That would be the one I'd like to have for our national anthem. But I'm recording this, and people are wondering, what am I doing? Okay, so, yeah, exactly. This is now, we are now looking at a new handout. This is, in fact, Monday, March 1, Rabbit. My wife got that already. I wish I knew where that came from, but she remembers it much more often than I do. And we're looking at something called responses of the postsynaptic cell to neurotransmitters. And this is actually, as you can see here, it's actually a kind of a stealthy kind of a thing. You can't really see it. So, this is actually looking at the ion flow and the importance of the ion flow, the different, what happens as the voltages change and how they change in response to different ion flows. And so you can see that there's various things that have to be filled out. I don't have them highlighted. So let's see here. I guess we can go down to here. So if you have an ion that crosses a concentration of an ion that's different across a semipermeable membrane, you're going to meet something that is, you're going to cause an electrical current. In living things, this current is generated by the pumping. It's foundationally generated by the pumping of the sodium potassium ATPase. That creates that electrochemical gradient. And if you have a homeostatic kind of thing in which the charge and the chemical gradient balance, where the opposite charges match the amount of chemical gradient between the semipermeable sides of the semipermeable membrane, you get a situation where the electrical gradient potential is equal to the chemical gradient potential. When that happens, and that happens, call that electrochemical equilibrium, the movement of the permeant ion is approximately zero, because you've got the chemical gradient that would normally you'd move from high concentration to low concentration, but the electrochemical gradient slows that movement of a charged particle to the point where it's not moving at all on a net basis. So if we designate change electrochemical potential for permeant ion J Z plus, plus receives the charge, such as delta micron J, then electrochemical potential is written by this. This is, of course, Faraday equation. No. Nernst equation. There we go. So the activity is zero because we have the chemical gradient being opposed by an electrical gradient. And so you can say that the J is arbitrarily, the top form is arbitrarily outside, the concentration of the ion on the inside is arbitrarily in the denominator. And you can see here where the Z is the charge on the material, and F is a Faraday constant. The epsilon is the membrane potential, the voltage, inside versus outside. And you can see this gas constant, absolute temperature, activity of the ion. And typically what we do for biochemical purposes, the activity and the concentration are very similar, so we don't worry about it too much. All right. And as you can see, this equation up here is similar to what you would get in a... can I get all this on here? I'll just leave it like this. I don't know how much you have to add. A lot of... just a few things here and there. Okay. All right. As you can see here, this equation up here, the activity equation, is very similar to the delta G. You can see pieces of it. We've got the KEQ, which is proximal reactance. And here, and for a redox reaction. So you have it for chemical equilibrium production reaction and a redox reaction, minus NF delta E. So if you rearrange this equation and solve for the epsilon, that is, solve for the voltage, you can see this being rearranged, and then you pull it around like this to the epsilon. So it's this equation up here solved for epsilon is all that is, and you get a form of the Nernst equation. And you can see now where the Nernst equation then, at least for this form of it, where the epsilon at 20 degrees is 58 millivolts ZF times 2.3 log of this, and 37 or 310 K gets 61 millivolts the charge and the Faraday constant, looking at the concentration gradient difference. So you can figure out what the voltage is going to be based on the temperature, as in the first equation, or a different temperature on the second equation, 20 or 37, versus the voltage, which is the dependent variable, and the independent variable is the concentration of the ions inside and out, inside and out. Now, this will be on the next test. Is that correct? I'm now, just now, loading up the review audio on my webpage. And so it should be there sometime 15 or 20 minutes, maybe half an hour after this class ends. So if you want to listen to the review that I had. Did you get the review sheet? Yeah. Now, I put it on D2L as well. Okay. All right. No, this is on the next test. Test 3. This is test 3. Shall we do a little classroom management issue? Let's see if we can just mentally review this pretty quickly. So Wednesday is what?
Test.
Now, the test, I can tell you, is the vast majority of the points are in multiple choice. These multiple choice are the ones I have written, and there are 50 of them, multiple choice questions. Then, before you get to those 50, there's a page and a quarter of short answer type questions, okay? And so you have a page and quarter of that, and then 50 multiple choice. Now, 50 multiple choice in 50 minutes is a little tough, actually. So I have asked Grace, who's going to be the proctor for it, if she would come in at 8, which she's going to anyway, and you could come in and start on the test at 8, or whenever she gets in here. So 8 to 9:20 or 9:30 or whatever it is. So that's on Wednesday, is that correct? We don't have class on Friday or
Monday.
Okay. Nor do we have lab on next Monday. Do we have lab this Monday? Yes, exactly. Okay, so let's take a look at a specific permeate ion. So, again, we see the same equation we just saw before, where a permeate ion, some J ion at 20 degrees Celsius is that 58 millivolts VZF and then log of this. And so it all works out that direction. Let's see now. Yeah. I think what's the problem with this is an ever so slight error. I think the F needs to be crossed out here. I think. Yeah. Cross the F out here. If we're going to get 58 and cross the F out here, if we're going to get 61. In other words, that I think that F term is already integrated into the 58 millivolts. So if you do that, then there's no problem then this equation and that equation should match. Well, no, wait a minute. This is 2.3 in the ZF. Obviously, I had this problem last year, and I failed to correct it. I'm going to have to figure out. I'm pretty sure that this is the actual, this one right here, what it's supposed to be. But I've got, see, this. If this is 2.3 in a log, then that should actually, if this these numbers are supposed to be correct, that should be a lower, that should be an LN, not an LOG. An LN, not an LOG. Let me double check on my notes, and I'll get this centered. I think this is the correct one right here. But there's something not right about these two. Anyway, and I'm right off the top of my head, I'm not prepared to try to figure that out. Let's see. What would that be? Anybody have a calculator here? Why would you mind going ahead and actually... what would that be? If you multiplied 8.314 times 293 and divided it by 96,500, you should get something like 0.058 volts. 0.025. All right, then multiply it by 2.3.
0.058.
Okay. All right, so then what's the problem here? Then what actually is happening here is the F is already factored in here, as well as the 2.3. Is that correct? Yeah. So this should be, you should cancel out the F here and cancel out the 2.3 here. Cancel out the F here and the 2.3 here. If I had an overhead marker, I would cross that out, but I didn't bring it today. So this is, in fact, the most correct of the terms right here. So this is the correct, and you simply should re-edit these to make this. And so this is basically illustrating where you got these numbers from, but it shouldn't be 58 up there. It should be something else. All right. Which means that a 10 to 1 gradient inside-outside gives a 58 millivolt equilibrium potential. pH gradient across the mitochondria is 1.4 or minus 154 millivolts for EH, since hydrogen ion equals 25 hydrogen ion. All right, some representative data for mammalian cytoskeletal. Okay, so here is... What in the world is what is this statement? This is always an interesting one. It's kind of confusing. The ratio of the pH gradient across the mitochondrial membrane is 1.4. And so, in other words, that the difference between inside and outside is 1.4 units. If you plug that into here, you get minus 145 millivolts. For EJ when J is equal to hydrogen ion. Well, the 1.4 pH units, of course, that pH is a power of 10. If you were to use that, if you were to eliminate the power of 10, 1.4 is a ratio of 1 to 25 in terms of the actual concentration of the hydrogen ion units. So that's where, because 25, let's see, 1.4... 10 to the 1.4 should be 25, I think. No?
Yeah.
So, because, in other words, the pH ratio is a logarithmic function, so a difference of 1.4 ratio gives you a change of one hydrogen ion outside versus 25 inside. Now, when you look at this, then on number 5 on the second page, some representative data for mammalian cytoskeletal elements or ions at 37 degrees. You've got the extracellular fluid, intracellular fluid concentration. So this is the out, that's the in. Ratio of 145 to 12 is 12. You take that ratio, you plug it in here. Not at 58, because this is at 20 degrees Celsius. You should put it into what? The 61, so that's at 37, and you get a value of 66. Potassium at minus 97. Calcium, notice millimolar, micromolar, a ratio of 1500, greater than 97 volts positive, and the chloride ion 120 and 4, 30, voltage of minus 90. Now, if this is all the ion currents that's going on in a cell, then you can look at these ratio of the concentrations, multiplying it by their permeabilities, and you can get a voltage based on that. And that's called the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. And now, you will not be responsible for the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation in terms of any kind of calculation. You will be responsible for a calculation either at 20 degrees Celsius like it is here or 37 degrees Celsius like it is on the previous page, in which the 58 actually becomes a 61. But not this one. This Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation says that you take the concentration of the sodium on the outside times its permeability through the membrane, all divided by, well, plus the permeability times the concentration of chloride, permeability of chloride times its chloride ion concentration, all over the same thing for the inside plus the inside plus the inside for the sodium, potassium, and chlorine that are there. When you have that, this equation can be used to calculate the RMP, resting membrane potential. Not the action potential, but the resting membrane potential. In other words, if it's just sitting there living and not transmitting a signal, you can get this resting membrane potential. All cells that are living have a resting membrane potential. And typically for a neuron, it turns out to be minus 70. This is pretty close to the voltage for potassium, which is about 90 millivolts. Deviations from that voltage reflect active transport and changes in membrane permeability to other ions. In other words, that you can alter this. If you stimulate the cell and you're no longer asking it just to exist at resting membrane potential, that number will change based on the ion that's being altered or the permeability that's being altered. And here is the bottom line right here that's, I think, very interesting about this whole thing. And it's very cool. Now, when a neurotransmitter, NT, increases the permeability of the postsynaptic membrane to a single ion, the membrane potential, EM, moves toward the equilibrium potential of that ion. That statement we can look at up here. So, if we were just looking at the sodium ion in a resting skeletal muscle, for example, and we hit it with a neurotransmitter that increased the sodium potential, or sodium current, normally it's about minus 60 is the resting membrane potential for neurons, and it's pretty close to that for other cells. But if you increase the permeability of the sodium, it would move toward a positive charge, move toward the positive 66 if the sodium was increased. If you were to increase the potassium permeability, it would move from a minus 70 more toward a minus 90. So in other words, that as you increase the permeability of a cell for a particular ion, the voltage across that membrane around that area where the permeability is increasing moves toward the voltage that exists, electrochemical voltage that exists for that ion in that region. Okay, so here you go. An increase in permeability for sodium changes the voltage for the membrane, that's what the M stands for, of a neuron from minus 70 towards a plus 66. And the membrane depolarizes as the membrane becomes more positive. So if you're having a neurotransmitter that's opening up the sodium channel, you're becoming depolarized because the voltage moves toward that. An increase in potassium permeability changes the voltage of the membrane of a neuron from minus 70 toward a minus 90, and the membrane becomes hyperpolarized, even more negative, as the voltage becomes more negative. This is the interesting thing. This is the bottom line here on that stuff. Oop, this goes here. This goes here. Any questions so far, by the way? No? Okay. Is everybody okay? Did you get enough sleep this weekend and all that kind of thing? No. You didn't. What? Yes, exactly. We're all... At a loss for words. We're in awe. Exactly right. Truly. We all genuflect in your direction. And are obsequious to you, O Canada. Is there no other Canadians in here, are there? No? Okay. We're good. My best friend is Canadian. A guy named Max Jardine. And so I can no longer speak to him. It's ruined our friendship because the United States lost. And finally, an increase in permeability of chloride decreases the resistance of a neural membrane, but essentially does not change the voltage of the membrane, since EM is approximately equal to the ECL. Really? It is? Seriously? So what is the chloride charge? It's about minus 90, and it's pretty close to that minus 70. So even if you do increase the permeability of the chloride ion, you're not going to change the voltage of the membrane very much. Okay, so, but there's always a big but. There's a big but here. And it says that the decrease in resistance lowers the voltage, which is essentially a short circuit event. So if the permeability increases too much, you can basically just short circuit the thing. The neurotransmitter GABA, gamma aminobutyric acid, increases PCL. Now, there is a typo here. That should be a capital P and a subscripted CL. So that should be increases the permeability of the chloride ion and hence hyperpolarizes the postsynaptic membrane, producing an inhibitory postsynaptic response, or an IPSP. All right, so you have an axon. You've got a synapsis in which the synapsis crosses over and touches a dendrite. The synaptic end of it, the presynaptic cell, releases GABA, which binds to a chloride channel and opens up that chloride channel. And that chloride channel then produces a voltage that is more negative, and that hyperpolarizes the membrane, and you get this inhibitory postsynaptic potential. So you have nerves that have a variety of inputs coming in simultaneously. And some of the inputs are excitatory and some are inhibitory. And depending on how that, you know, if depending on the intensity of the response, the neuron has to integrate it appropriately to figure out exactly when or if it should fire. So just the very act of moving your arms back and forth, there's various inputs saying, okay, fire, 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 stop firing. You know, fire, 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 stop firing. And so all that stuff happens unconsciously and is important for us to be able to control our voluntary muscles, among other things. When you look at Parkinson's disease, what a terrible disease that is to have,
not the end of the world, like certain types of cancer, but it is sad.
Where you see firsthand what it's like when they're, when this feedback between the neurons and so on is lost, and you can't control your hands and arms and fine movement. When a neurotransmitter decreases the permeability of postsynaptic membrane to a single ion, the membrane potential moves away from the equilibrium for that ion and toward the equilibrium potential with the dominant permeability. So a decreased sodium permeability hyperpolarizes, and in decreased potassium permeability depolarizes. In other words, this is the inverse of what you would normally think. 10 in a bottle to explain the wide variety of observed responses to a given neurotransmitter. The neurotransmitter receptor is what the neurotransmitter binds to on the postsynaptic cell membrane. The ion channel protein, or the ionophore, is separate and distinct from the neurotransmitter receptor protein. In other words, they're saying the ionophore and the receptor are not necessarily the same. There are some that are the same, but they're not it's not necessary for that to be. Functional unit is a combination of the binding proteins for the neurotransmitter and its ionophore, called a neurotransmitter receptor complex. And so when the neurotransmitter binds the receptor protein, it changes the conformation, produces a change in the ionophore, and the ionophore begins to open up. And lastly, the change in the ionophore conformation affects the passage of ions through the gates. Ionophore contains a filter that conforms to opening and closing the ion gate. Only certain ions are allowed through the gate according to ion charge and hydrated radii. Filter varies with the neurotransmitter complex. Different neurotransmitter receptor proteins can be associated with the same ionophore. So you can have the same ionophore that's being affected by multiple neurotransmitters, because the receptor proteins bind the neurotransmitter and then transmit that information to an ionophore, and you can have multiple neurotransmitters doing that. Again, another level of control in which you would have multiple neurotransmitters secreted from a synapsis, and the integration, the combination of that is going to determine the intensity of the opening on the ionophore. Amazing. Honestly, amazing. Are there any questions about this? All right. There are no questions about this. I'm going to turn the lights on for a moment and get whatever act I have together by putting my overheads together. And that. That with here. Does everybody have an overhead for this? Not yet. I need to put this in there. Okay. Remind me to make those transitions, make those changes in this. It's silly for me to keep it like that. Now, what I've handed out to you, ladies and gentlemen, is something known as Chapter 11. There was, when I developed this a year or so ago, I used a textbook. I decided not to have you buy the textbook. I can get you all the information you need. That's why it says Chapter 11, Acetylcholine. It's Biochem 422, not 423. But at any rate, So there's no chapter 11 per se, and there is a little bit of talk about acetylcholine. I don't have any, or I don't have much here to talk about. Let me not talk about to fill in, but there's a few things. So let me just say, you see where it says fund 8.1? That is my code for putting in the figure 8.1 you see there. So you can just cross that out. This is dealing with figure 8.1. How did they find the first neurotransmitter? We've looked now a little bit at all the different neurotransmitters. You have something that you know how they found the first neurotransmitter? Yes, actually it's Otto Louis. Otto Louis. Right, there it is. But good, you remember that. And where'd you learn it from? What?
Did he have a dream?
Oh, I don't know the story of it. He may have.
No, during your mind in our
session. Oh! Very nice. You know, dreams are very powerful things. I wish I would have them more often. I don't. You guys have dreams? I seldom have a dream that I remember. If I remember a dream, it's only because I've woken up, I've fallen back asleep, and then I wake up again, you know, like on a Sunday morning or something. And when I wake up that second time, I remember having dreams. But I don't remember dreaming last night. Did you dream last night? You guys dream in color or black and white? Color? In 3D, like Avatar? The blue Navi or whatever those people are? Okay, well, Otto Louis, apparently in his dream, said, I've got to figure this out. Is this chemical or electrical? So what did he do? He put a frog heart. There we go. Suspended in a Ringer's solution, which enables it to continue to move along. It has some energy metabolism in it. And so they would draw out the vagus nerve, and the heart would spontaneously beat outside of the body until they began to stimulate the vagus nerve. And when they stimulated the vagus nerve, it would stop beating. And when you stop stimulating, it'd start beating again. So they did that several times, and all they did then was move the Ringer solution from the heart that they were stimulating into a different heart, and this other heart, again, was beating without external stimulation. But as the material flowed from the Ringers, from the stimulated heart to the unstimulated heart, the heart began to stop beating, just like up here. And since there was no electrical connection between the two, they said there must be some sort of chemical being released into the Ringer that, when transferred to another beating heart, slows it down. The result, demonstrating that the nerve stimulation limited substance that mimicked the action of electrical stimulation, led to the conclusion that the neurotransmission is chemical in nature. Yes, chemical in nature. For those of you who are chemists, hallelujah. Yes, the Biochemist's Full Employment Act is the fact that virtually everything dealing in health is chemically related. So how do we know a neurotransmitter exists as a neurotransmitter? You need to know these four things, five things. And you can scratch out that B. If you're going to identify it as a neurotransmitter, you've got to know that it's synthesized by a neuron, that it's released from a neuron and recognized by some other chemical or pharmacological process or method. It should produce a specific event on the postsynaptic cell, should be able to be blocked by a known competitor, called an antagonist, and the methods must exist to terminate the action of the transmitter. That's exactly correct. In other words, that the body, of course, as you know from first semester, if the body makes something, it has to figure out a way to get rid of it. And so that's exactly what happens. The body makes a neurotransmitter, and it's got to figure out a way to destroy its action or activity. If you can't figure out how it destroys it, or if it doesn't destroy it, you're probably not looking at a neurotransmitter.
I have lost my mind.
Oh, it's over there. Can you tell I'm not feeling well? Does it matter to you? It does. Only because the class is even more boring than normal? Because I'm not feeling well? All right. Acetylcholine is the first. That's what Otto Louis' frog developed, was circulating AC. So the acetylcholine has got a, capital C, lowercase h. That's the abbreviation for acetylcholine. The first transmitter discovered by Louis in 1921, acts at the neuromuscular junction. And the acetylcholine was used to discover that quantum behavior. Remember the quantum behavior we talked about earlier? That was all done using acetylcholine. So one-step synthesis. Acetylcholine plus choline yields acetylcholine. And so here's the material. You need to write that down. You got acetyl-CoA. You got your choline right here. If this was attached to a phosphatidyl group, it would be called phosphatidylcholine. What's another name for phosphatidylcholine, since I'm talking about it? Lecithin. CHAT is the enzyme. Choline acyl transferase. Plus CoA are called CoASH as well. Nerve cells, acetyl-CoA supplied to mitochondria. Enzyme choline acetyltransferase, or CHAT, which is this thing. Cytoplasmic, which is in the cytoplasm of the cell. Choline is found in the plasma, blood plasma, high concentration. Transported into the nerve by sodium transporter. So it's a SymPort. And the CHAT enzyme is the definitive marker for cholinergic neurons. Because CHAT is the sole enzyme in the synthesis, CHAT is not the rate-limiting step, apparently. Because they can add more acetyl-CoA and it'll go faster. And so apparently the limiting factor is the amount of acetyl-CoA in there. So transport of acetyl-CoA is maybe the limiting step. Then it gets transported into vesicles by the vesicular cholinergic transporter, which we know is one of those many proteins in the synaptic vesicle. And, okay, oddly enough, that the coding region for that transporter turns out to be in the first intron, intervening sequence, of the CHAT gene. The intron that's removed, the intervening sequence, the exon that you keep, the intron is the transporter. Isn't that interesting? So there's that overlap in the gene expression of the things. Autoregulation receptors exist on the presynaptic membrane that regulate the release. In other words, there's a feedback control on the presynaptic vesicle that keeps it from releasing too much. They're called cholinergic release modulating autoreceptors. They're found in the peripheral nervous system and also the central nervous system. So acetylcholine is not only used at the nerve muscular junction, but it's used throughout the body. Now, I've made it, you need to redo this, the nicotinic type, not the muscarinic type of receptor is found in muscle junctions. So the nicotinic type is found in the muscle junction. This is why pure nicotine is toxic or deadly to small animals. I don't know if you've ever seen this. They used to do this many years ago. They would, to try to get people to stop smoking, they would get a mouse and get a drop of nicotine and just put it on its lips, as it were. And in a few minutes later, the mouse would be dead because the nicotinic type receptors at the muscle junctions froze up because of the nicotine, and it basically suffocated. And how you activate? Now you need to cross out the anti is not correct here. The cholinesterases degrade the acetylcholine into acetyl groups and choline groups. However, serine and other organophosphates such as parathion and malathion are potent neurotoxins for insects, and they are the anticholinesterases. So the cholinesterases degrade the acetylcholine, and that's what should actually normally happen. You want the acetylcholine to be degraded quickly to turn off the signal for a muscle contraction. But serine and other potent neurotoxins, especially parathion and malathion for insects, inhibit the cholinesterase, keeping the acetylcholine at a high level and eventually suffocating the animal, or insect in this case. It smells horrible. But if you want, I don't know if you can even buy this stuff anymore, but parathion and malathion are very potent insecticides because they act at such a crucial place in the ant's physiology. They can't mutate around that anticholinesterase. Well, that's it for today, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be done for the day. We know we're about 2 minutes early because I want to be quit, be done. Go blow my nose in private. Okay, so what's happening on Wednesday, ladies and gentlemen? Yeah, test number two.